From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Evan Kleiman, and this is Good Food. Today on this show, a Japanese food shopping expedition with a cookbook author as our guide, a trip to Little Arabia in Orange County for some traditional Iraqi fare, a fresh look at Zinfandel, even the dreaded white Zin. Plus, a food historian looks at America's history of drinking alcohol. But first, let's check in with Laura Avery at the Santa Monica Farmers Market to find out what's fresh and in season this chilly week in Southern California.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. I'm visiting with James Trees, who is a chef here at the market who is part of a new concept of pop-ups called This Is Not a Pop-Up. And he is basically hosting various chefs at a location, James, you're going to tell me exactly where it is, that chefs can come and do a short-term pop-up and hone their skills, try something new, attract new followers, and just basically come and play in the kitchen. So tell us more about that, James, and then what your role is and what you're going to be doing.
So basically, I'm doing the first week, which is at Square One Dining at 4854 Fountain Avenue. And basically, I'm doing a five-course menu for $50, which is basically the structure that we're going for moving forward. I am going to be the chef MC of the place, but basically that all that means is that I'm going to help the other chefs make sure that they are able to execute their visions inside of the time frame that we have.
And also explain, the pop-up is open 4 days a week and there's a new chef every week, right?
Right. So I am going to be in the kitchen helping them out from Thursday to Sunday, which is the days of the pop-up. And we are going to have a different chef every single week. So next week is Adam Gertler. He's doing a modern Jewish deli. And then we have Bruce Coleman from the Churchill doing amazing pasta tasting.
So you're going to be cooking this weekend. There's two more days left for you before the next chef comes in. And what are you going to be cooking?
One thing we're focusing on is this barley risotto. So basically we're taking pearl barley, we're cooking it in mushroom stock, and then we're going to be pairing it with like some really great produce from the market here. We're going to be using Alex Weiser's broccoli de Checo, which is just like a wild broccoli that I've been falling in love with for like the last couple of years, and he's been getting a really good crop in. And then also our mushrooms are from Clearwater, and David does a great job with all of his mushrooms and all the products, and right now they're amazingly in season. He has his biggest selection during the winter because here up against the coast, that's where it incubates all those mushrooms, and they can go forage and get all the wild goodness that's, you know, hanging out inside of Temescal Canyon, and like everything's free, so he can come back and give us the great deals that he finds.
What a great idea and what a great concept and what a fun way for people to come and for you, obviously, to just go hang out in the kitchen with all these great chefs and just go wild. So, James, how can we find you and make reservations?
Okay, so our website is www.thisisnotapopup.com.
Okay, well, it really does sound fun, and I hope it goes on, and I hope everybody goes and it catches on. Thanks so much.
It's been my pleasure to be here, and I can't wait to see everyone.
That was James Trees. He's the MC at This Is Not a Pop-Up, and basically it's a semi-permanent pop-up where chefs can go and play and execute menus 4 days a week. No limits, anything they want to do, and just go to the kitchen to have fun. David Karp is here at the market, as he always is on Wednesday when he's in town and not out about finding new culinary and produce discoveries around the world. And David, you just spent a very interesting time down in Fallbrook with Jim Russell, who is a macadamia farmer, and found out some true facts about the macadamia nut production in California. Can you tell us all about that?
You know, it started about 6 years ago with an article that was in the Los Angeles Times magazine section in which Jim was quoted as saying that there are 2,500 acres of macadamias in California. And I thought, wow, that's a huge amount of macadamias. Where are they? I mean, there's 2,500 acres of persimmons and you see them all over the place at farmers markets, at supermarkets. If there are that many macadamias, you think that there would be co-ops and packing houses and they'd be all over the place. But he insisted that that was the case. So I visited him the last Saturday in December, and it was amazing in more ways than one. He's got 200 trees of macadamia that were planted in the 1980s under circumstances that I'll describe in a minute. Now, if you've seen Jim, you notice that he's in a wheelchair, and I always realize something must have happened at some point. But the true story is sad, inspiring, and amazing. He was born in Pennsylvania 71 years ago, and at age 17, he signed up for the Marines He served on a heavy cruiser in Vietnam. He served for 20 years. It got to the rank of major. He had 5 kids with his first wife. He got divorced. He met a woman named Barbara, who's his wife now. He was following her. She was in her car. He was on his motorcycle on a road in Fallbrook when somehow he went off the road. He was brought to the hospital in San Diego, and the doctor said, sorry, your spinal cord has been severed. You'll never walk again. He said, the heck with that, or probably something a little stronger. So this is the early 80s, got a disability pension. He's getting an MBA at San Diego State College. And he embarked on a project to see whether macadamia cultivation was economically practical for Southern California. He decided it was, and he decided to plant this orchard himself. 200 trees of macadamias. And when I say himself, even though he was in a wheelchair, he actually planted these trees himself. He dug the holes and put them in. I asked him, how did you do that? And he said, I just had to prove to myself that I could do it. So this is not just an orchard for him. It's proof of his triumph over disability.
So David, on the macadamia nuts, they always seem to be very, very expensive. And you were saying that very few of these macadamias that are grown actually make it to market, that before they became popularized here, they were used as pig food?
Well, no, they're currently being sold for a couple of reasons. They're for a couple of purposes. One of them is that a large part of the constituency that buys them are raw foodies and vegans, for whom it represents a source of dietary fat. And, they have sort of a creamy but crunchy texture. They're surprisingly different than the macadamias that you would get from Hawaii or from God knows where around the world. They're sweeter, larger, a little bit more oval rather than round, and uniquely better suited to eating fresh, basically raw. Some people feed them to birds. They're also sold to a farm that raises pigs. In Hawaii, where there are lots of wild pigs, they're a pest. They were ravaging the macadamia groves and feasting on these macadamia nuts. And they found these pigs that feasted on macadamia nuts were the most delicious pigs in the world. And so somebody down here in Southern California is actually doing the same thing.
So it's like the acorn-fed pig times 10.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
So the season, he comes every other week. So he's going to be here on the 23rd and then 2 weeks later of January and then 2 weeks later than that. And his season is basically from September or October to March. So how many acres are there? You can't always believe official agricultural statistics, particularly for these minor crops. But San Diego County Agricultural Commissioner says that there are 67 harvested acres.
All right. Well, this is good to know. And not only do macadamia, one of the most delicious nuts ever, but great appreciation for the farmer, Jim Russell, who grows them and brings them here.
All right. Thanks so much. It's been a pleasure talking to you, as
David,
always.
David, as always, we learn more than we ever thought we could ever understand about macadamia nuts and understand them better. And thanks so much for the information.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
That was David Karp, who is the expert on so many things because of his intense commitment and passion and level of research that he does on all these items. So always a pleasure to catch up with him. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
A recipe for the barley risotto that James talked about is on the Good Food blog. Now let's take a little trip to Orange County, specifically to Little Arabia, to a restaurant called Al Tanur. It was the first Iraqi restaurant in Orange County, and Gustavo Arellano joins me now to talk about it. Gustavo is, of course, the editor of the OC Weekly and the voice of Orange County Eats here on Good Food. He's got tips on what to order at Al Tanur.
The best dish in Iraq, the national dish, is something called tashrib. So tashrib, it's funny because when you go there, you see the menu, you know what it is, you know what the menu is. You have your shish kebabs, you have your Middle Eastern style pizzas, all the Lebanese dishes that we consider to be Middle Eastern food. And then you have this smaller menu, all in Arabic with pictures. So you point out the tashrib, I guarantee you the owner, he's a nice guy, but he's going to say, how'd you find out about the dish? Why are you ordering it? And tashrib, it's a humongous lamb shank, humongous. Bone marrow all the way in, oozing out, and they put the lamb shank on top of a humongous piece of folded bread called kubs. And kubs, we know pita, we know maybe like,
Laffa.
Laffa. We know, of course, sangak, the Persian breads. There's a lot of common Middle Eastern flatbreads here in Southern California, But I think Hoob's is the best one of them all. So imagine a pita, but a little bit thicker, and now the size of a basketball hoop. They make it fresh there at Al Tanur. They make it fresh there every day. I guess they must saute it. They fold it, so and then they cover it. And this really like curry that, you know, you think curry in the Middle East. Well, apparently what happened is there's a lot of Indian migrant workers that go through Iraq. So they brought over their curry. So it's a lighter curry. It's kind of sweet, like a mole poblano. And it's drenched in it. So essentially the kubs, it takes on the consistency of an omelet. And then on top of that, you have the lamb shank, and that's it.
And so you pick apart the lamb and tuck it into the bread and put it in your mouth?
No, you can do it like that because they'll give you a side of kubs on the side. The first time I ate it with a fork. And then afterwards, the owner's like, that's nice for you. But in Iraq, we get the kubs, almost like injera bread, actually. Of course, the Ethiopian flatbread. And so you get the kubs, you tear off a chunk of the lamb, you tear off a chunk of that soggy kubs, you scrape it through the curry, and then you eat it like that. It's gamey. Slightly sweet, just the tiniest bit spicy, and then that all that earthiness of that bread. And the great thing about the kubs, they make it fresh every day, and more importantly, they have it on sale. So if you want to take some home and just, oh gosh, it would be great if you get some yogurt or you get some tzatziki or hummus. And the great thing with kubs, oh gosh, it'll last you a whole week.
So aside from this dish, say the name again.
The name of the dish is tashrib.
Okay. So what else should we order there besides the tashrib?
The kebabs and all that, that's fine. But when you want to order Iraqi, ask them to translate the menu for you. And they're going to tell you again, well, are you sure you want them? You know, this isn't your kind of food. But if you're insistent enough, eventually they'll relent. Another great dish that's always selling, it's called kaba musilia. It's a fried pie, has minced meat inside. The other great dish is actually another national dish from Iraq. It's called, I think it's called maskouf. This is really great. So you get like white fish. They slowly marinate it over an open fire. So the flesh becomes nice and milky. The skin becomes really crispy. Some of the flesh also becomes crispy. And then they put it over a rice pilaf. And that's it. They put some lemon on it. You get the kubs. You just start digging all the way through. And one thing people usually forget about Middle Eastern cuisine, they forget seafood is a huge It's a huge deal, especially in Iraq. You have the Tigris and Euphrates River. You know, this is a cuisine that's thousands of years old. Fish is always going to be a part of that. But in Little Arabia, you don't really see too many of those dishes. So this is one of the few places in Little Arabia in Orange County where you could get a Middle Eastern-style seafood dish.
Thank you so much, Gustavo.
Gracias.
Gustavo Arellano is the editor of the OC Weekly. You can hear his voice on KCRW's new weekly feature, Orange County Line, which airs on Mondays at 4:44. Find all of Gustavo's restaurant suggestions on the Good Food Restaurant Map, which is on the Good Food blog. Attention, attention, all you OC listeners. We're returning to Orange County. It's our fifth collaborative Good Food and OC Weekly Happy Hour on Thursday, February 7th. We're having it at the brewery in Placentia. So save the date and keep an eye out for details over on the Good Food blog. Coming up, do you feel too intimidated to shop at your local Asian grocery store? Do those walls of miso and aisles of rice just make you flustered? Well, I can totally sympathize. So I took a trip to Mitsuo Market with a seasoned cookbook author to learn the ropes. Stay tuned.
Head over to the KCRW store to shop for vacations, wine classes, frequent flyer miles, dinners, and more, all in support of KCRW. They won't last long. Check it out now at kcrw.com/store.
Welcome back to Good Food. In 2012, we followed chef and cookbook author Debbie Lee to a Korean market where she decoded the aisles of soy sauce, the giant displays of gochujang, and freezers full of rice cakes for us. This year, we're tackling the Japanese grocery store, which for me was just as mysterious. Cookbook author Andrea Nguyen agreed to be my guide. So we met at Mitsuo Market at Venison Sentinella, and we began our tour, which started in the dried mushroom aisle, which I have to say is a pretty intimidating place to begin.
I think a lot of what people are thinking of in terms of dried Asian mushrooms are the shiitake mushrooms. And they come in a variety of different cap thicknesses. Let's think about that. For example, you'll see at your regular market, such as like they're kind of thin looking, like those Dynasty brand right there. But what you want to do is kind of adjust your mind to pay a little bit more. And the thicker cap mushrooms are going to cost you more, say in like the $10 to $15 range for a package instead of, say, $1.50 or $2.
Are we looking for whole mushroom caps instead of sliced? Will that give us a better quality?
Totally. You do not know where those sliced mushrooms came from. Go for whole mushrooms. Make sure that they look almost, you know, they look thick and they look voluptuous and they look kind of bulbous, not so much like flat ones.
And then what can we do with them?
What you want to do is you need to rehydrate them. And if you have time, what I do is I rehydrate them overnight in cold water at room temperature. Don't just like, you know, think last minute and then just pour a bunch of hot water over and then start squeezing on them, which I've done before and kind of works. But, you know, if you just let them sit overnight, they'll plump up and they'll just develop flavor more slowly. It's sort of like slow rehydration.
And then does the resulting broth that you get from that become much more flavorful to use?
Totally. If you want to, like, if you're a vegetarian and you want to use that soaking liquid for a little meatiness in your food, go ahead and save it. It can be overpowering sometimes, so just, you know, add a little bit at a time when you're using it. And also, you know what, save those mushroom stems. People kind of discard them, but you can use them later on to add flavor to your food. And also, once those mushrooms are rehydrated, you can just, you know, remove them from their liquid and keep them in the refrigerator for days.
What do you do with them?
I slice them up. I put them into stir fries. I drop them into soup. I put them into even Thanksgiving stuffing.
That's so great. So also in this dehydrated aisle, which I kind of love, are all the dehydrated fish.
Right. You want to think about little dehydrated shrimp. That is a great source of umami. And if you're going to have pantry items to make Asian food, one of the things that you want to do is stock up on seaweed and dried shaved bonito flakes, katsuobushi, for making dashi. And they're conveniently sold here in these little kind of like 5-gram or 3-gram packages. And a lot of recipes written in Japanese cookbooks are written for those size packages. So conveniently, you kind of know how much you need.
So I'm looking at this aisle, and I see nothing anywhere to show me that there are bonito flakes. I see no sign saying bonito flakes.
Welcome to the world of Asian market shopping. It is so confusing. If you have never seen this stuff before, you've never seen katsuobushi in a plastic package, you're not going to know what to look for. Because you know what? All of us, I imagine, our Japanese is a little rusty. For example, I have this little iPhone app called the Asian Market Shopper. And so it has, like, you can look up dried bonito flakes or katsuobushi, hold it up at the store and ask for it.
That's pretty awesome. So what else in this aisle strikes your fancy? Are we in the soy sauce aisle?
Let's call it the condiment aisle, the dry goods and condiment aisles. And so here at Mitsuwa, you're going to see your chili sauces as well as togarashi, which people love to put on the ramen these days and use for other kinds of foods.
Describe what togarashi is.
Togarashi is Japanese chili pepper. And my favorite, to tell you the truth, a lot of people think about the blend, the 7-spice blend, but my favorite is just the pepper, the ichimi togarashi, which you really find served more in Japan on noodle soup tables, and it has more heat to it, a lot more sophistication, I think, and boldness and flavor. And you know, whenever you're buying Asian food products, and I know when I can't read all of the characters and stuff, I buy at the mid to high price level. Competition is so stiff in these ingredients that different brands will just price themselves up if there's a slight quality difference.
This is going to sound like a really remedial question, but I want to ask you about soy sauce. When we think about Kikkoman, that's a Japanese brand, correct?
Correct. Here's the deal with the soy sauces. Kikkoman that we see at a regular supermarket has probably been developed for the flavor profile that they think is going to fit Chinese, Japanese, Vietnamese, across the board, Pan-Asian food. But when you step into, say, a Japanese market, all of a sudden we're faced with, I think, what looks like about 8 different kinds of Kikkoman soy sauces.
It's really startling, actually. Here we have Kikkoman. We have the all-purpose that we see all the time in regular grocery stores. And right next to it, we have it, the label is in Japanese? Is it a different product?
It is a different product. And they're different price points. And then there's also grades of soy sauces for eating sushi. So all of a sudden now we're looking at soy sauces that are costing $11 a bottle. And the other thing too is sometimes there are little bottles of soy sauces with pictures of the soy sauce maker on them. They're artisanal soy sauces, and if you ever find those, buy it, because it's like really high grade stuff. And you know, you can just try. There are flavor differences. And you know, it may set you back maybe $5 for a little bottle of soy sauce, but you get some fabulous stuff.
We finally left the condiment aisle and headed over to the meat section.
The meat aisle is chock full of really cool things that you just have to mine. When you go to an Asian market, walk up and down the aisle, go at sort of like on a weekday when things aren't so busy so that there aren't customers jostling around. But the meat aisle, you can oftentimes find American Wagyu beef, you can find Berkshire pork, and they're all cut into really small portions so that you don't have to sink, you know, throw down a ton of money to just cook some of this stuff at home.
I saw a nice amount for one stir fry, good for one stir fry for a couple of people, of the American Wagyu beef for $4.55.
And a lot of these things are cut for like hot pots or sukiyaki or something like that. So you don't have to do that thin slicing yourself. You just have to go to the market and grab the stuff and bring a cooler when you go, because this is like perishable food. And the other wonderful thing that you can get at Asian markets, and particularly Japanese and Korean markets, is fish for sushi. And sometimes it's already cut and sometimes not, but you can come here and load up and go home and have your own little hand roll party. And, you know, it's fun, and you can be in your jammies.
That's so great.
And finally, we went in search of tofu.
Okay, so here we are at the soybean section, you've called it, because it isn't only tofu.
Right, it is natto and tofu, and actually just sort of across the way is the miso.
So let's talk about all this fresh tofu and all the different brands. I think a lot of us would be interested in non-GMO. Are any of them labeled non-GMO, even though there is no law that says they have to do that?
When you're looking and examining tofu labels, you want to just really take a good look to see if it's organic, if it's non-GMO. You know, it's like 93% of the soybeans grown in this country is GMO soybeans. And the non-GMO stuff is kind of hard to find. However, tofu makers are very sensible and sensitive to consumer trends and what they want. So over time, there has been more tofu produced in the United States and sold here that is non-GMO soybeans. And so when you're looking at the tub or the product label, and if you're concerned about non-GMO, sometimes it doesn't say non-GMO on the organic tofu. So that's sort of a decision that you have to make for yourself. And sometimes it'll say non-GMO, but not organic.
If we don't have a room in our refrigerator for the complete inventory of tofu types, what is the most useful?
I would go for a medium firm or a firm. If you're going to be just be like pan frying your tofu, I would go for a firm tofu or an extra firm. Don't go buying super firm tofu that's like in plastic packaging, because that's like the equivalent of, say, baseball mozzarella. Thank you very much. That stuff's great for grating or maybe for brining and then baking, but not really for everyday eating because it just won't suck up flavors well.
This has been so much fun, Andrea. Really, really a blast. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Evan, for inviting me along, and I feel like I need to like go shopping now and buy stuff.
Okay, let's go shop.
Andrea Nguyen's latest book is Asian Tofu. It's gorgeous. You can check out photos of our shopping trip and also find a list of Andrea's Asian market pantry staples on the Good Food blog. The New York Times list of food trends for 2013 cited fermentation as a buzzword for the coming year. Well, we here at Good Food aren't surprised. One of my favorite foods or condiments is fermented. I'm talking, of course, about kimchi, the fermented Korean cabbage that's chock full of umami. Last year, we spoke to Lauren Chun, owner of Mother-in-Law Kimchi, about her product. She returns to Good Food today to discuss her new book, The Kimchi Cookbook. So let's talk about kimchi in its most basic form. What does it mean when someone says kimchi? Is it just spicy pickled vegetable?
No, it's not necessarily spicy all the time. I guess the Chinese root word of kimchi comes really literally means salted vegetable. And so it's just a vast array of various different recipes of salted vegetable, which causes natural fermentation and lactic bacteria to cause it to turn into this delicious probiotic-rich raw food, which we know is kimchi.
But I think for a lot of us, that's definitely the part that we've embraced.
Yeah, absolutely. And the Korean culinary tradition, they only had access to chili pepper flakes, which originated from South America, not only up until like 17th century. So it's a fairly new thing to use chili pepper flakes throughout Korea, and not just even in kimchi, but throughout most of the cuisine that we think of Korean food as being really spicy. So it's kind of amazing what they've been able to do in terms of taking chili pepper flakes and really putting it in everything.
Sort of like Italians and tomatoes.
Exactly.
So if the definition is much wider and for centuries there was no chili, give us an idea of some of the kimchi that we might enjoy that has no chili.
I mean, there are really basic recipes that to me, you know, I mean, it just has so many parallels of what we think about it in the Eastern European tradition of sauerkraut and whatnot. But there's like this white kimchi that you make during the wintertime, and you use simple fruits and pantry items that are available. So using things like dried dates or pine nuts. And so you're putting basically the salted cabbage with these other fragrant pantry items. What you're trying to do throughout this preserving process, you know, especially during the long winters, cold winters, is trying to make that vegetable as flavorful as possible and then to get you through until next spring when you've got your new spring vegetables.
So interesting. And aside from the very traditional half or whole heads of cabbage that are put in the jars and then sunk into the ground, there's also a seasonal tradition that goes beyond that, isn't there?
Yeah, so really what we know of as kimchi, the one with the cabbage that's really used throughout. I mean, cabbage, you know, whenever it was readily available, was used because I think it was just highly prized for its flavor. And Napa cabbage in particular just grew all over Asia. But it also has such a delicate kind of sweetness to it and has a high water content than the kind of Western cabbage that we're accustomed to, the round green cabbages. But it's really important to remember that kimchi is a seasonal kind of summer delicate flavors, and using those delicate vegetables that are, you know, first of the spring, green onions or delicate lettuce, things like that with cucumbers, that really the flavor of the vegetable melds with the seasonings that you're using for the kimchi spice or whatnot, and you really have a very delicate flavor kimchi versus things that you're using for the winter months, using the root vegetables and cabbage and things that are much heartier in flavor.
One of the seasonal ones for this time of year that really caught my eye was a rolled up green cabbage kimchi with radish and Asian pear.
Yeah, that's a really nice one. I really wanted to be able to be a little bit playful as well as really serve the foundation of traditional Korean kimchi recipes. There's also one with the butternut squash, you know, adding a little bit of salt and releasing, you know, the squash's like delicious sweetness in its raw form, and then adding some kimchi spice. And kimchi spice, like when I'm referring it to like that, I'm really kind of talking about, you know, a combination of the Korean chili pepper flakes, which is gochugaru. It's very specific because that flavor profile is more earthy and spicy. So it's usually just a combination of chili pepper flakes, garlic, ginger, scallions, onions, you know, whatever. But it's really kind of, those are the key components. And then, you know, you can sort of choose to put in your fish sauce or shrimp or some other kind of protein seasoning to add flavor.
So let's talk about how we can use kimchi not only as a garnish, as a condiment to sort of, you know, pep up what we're eating, but also as we're cooking. One of the dishes that I'm looking at right now is scalloped potatoes with kimchi, which I think is just sort of a brilliant use of it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the theme of just the acidity of and the tanginess of kimchi and how that really, you know, works so well with creamy, kind of rich flavors, that, especially in the winter time. It's just a perfect match for it. I always tell people eggs and bacon and, you know, anything like that works really well. It was important for me not to just, you know, write the book and say, this is kimchi, but really make it accessible to an American kitchen and to make it as accessible to more people by not saying kimchi is not something that you have to eat with Korean food. In fact, it's so versatile and it can be something that's healthy and can be incorporated in your daily lives.
Well, you've done a beautiful job. It's a gorgeous book.
Thank you.
Lauren Chun is the owner of Mother-in-Law Kimchi. Her new book is The Kimchi Cookbook. You can find a recipe for her scalloped potatoes with kimchi, which I've made and is completely addictive, on the Good Food blog. And if you live in the LA area, you can find her kimchi in your local Whole Foods. Stick around. Coming up, we'll discuss the early days of American alcohol, the rise of the soda industry, plus a new look at, I have to say it, that dreaded white Zinfandel. I'll be right back.
Good Food is produced by KCRW, a listener-supported public radio station in Los Angeles, California. Support our programming by making a donation. Go to kcrw.com/join.
You're listening to Good Food on KCRW and kcrw.com. America has quite a history with beverages, from the Boston Tea Party to Prohibition to our current relationship with the double half-calf Sumatra latte low-fat soy. Frequent Good Food guest, a prolific writer of food scholarship, Andrew Smith, returns to walk us through our drinking history, the name of his latest book. So starting at the beginning, what were the colonists drinking? Could they drink the water?
It depended on where you were. If you're in New England, the water was great. If you were in the South, the water was less enjoyable, I'll phrase it that way. But it didn't matter whether you had good water or bad water. What they really wanted was alcohol. And in many ways, the colonial era was a period of time in which everybody drank, including women and children. And it has been aptly dubbed the Alcoholic Republic.
Now, when you say that children drank, are we talking about brews that are much less alcoholic than they are now?
Some were. You had ciderkin, which is cider, which was a major American alcoholic beverage in colonial and early American period. That would have been 6 or 7% alcohol. But for children, the equivalent was about 2 or 3%. But they also drank rum and they drank everything else that was not available. That was what people drank. It wasn't an exception for children.
For the masses, were beer and cider the primary tipples?
It really started with cider was the main drink of America, particularly of the lower class, until the 1840s when lager beer came in with German immigration. And that's when lager beer becomes the beverage of choice for the middle and lower class.
In terms of what we preferred to drink early on, beyond cider and beyond beers, what were the preferred spirits?
The main spirit of the colonial era was rum, and that remained an important beverage all the way until the early 19th century. And rum, of course, was a product of sugar refining in the Caribbean.
When did we seem to switch from rum being the American drink to whiskey being the American drink?
Whiskey comes in with Scotch-Irish immigration in the 18th century, so you have the beginning of that at that point. But as soon as you have this imported item after the American Revolution, there are restrictions on imports, so there are no restrictions on producing whiskey. Whiskey becomes America's hard beverage of choice about the 1790s.
What beverages were introduced to the public when alcohol was no longer an option legally during Prohibition?
This was one of the interesting things which started me on writing the book in the first place. It's the relationship between alcohol and non-alcoholic beverages. So, for instance, the soda industry really is launched by temperance advocates and those that supported prohibition. And the goal was to provide a beverage that could attract Americans away from the whiskey and the rum and the beer and the other products, the alcoholic beverages that they were consuming. So you begin to have the soda industry, which has been America's number one beverage from about the 1950s on, when it overtook coffee, which at that point had been. The temperance movement begins in the late 18th century and very quickly expands during the 19th century. And one of the things that the temperance movement tried to do is figure out that there had to be something that kids could drink other than alcoholic beverages. And so they began to stress milk, which at the same time, many American women stopped breastfeeding earlier than they had previously. So milk became the children's beverage in the mid-19th century. And of course, it continues that way today. So you have these interesting connections there too.
The fact that Coca-Cola-based drinks were first served in pharmacies and drugstores seems somehow related to the whole temperance prohibition response to hard alcohol.
Yes, you have a druggist in Atlanta who was making a lot of money selling coca wine. Coca wine was a very popular beverage in the late 19th century. And this was made by druggists, and it was sold as a medicine. So that was part of this. But if you really wanted to make money, you needed to reach a much wider audience. And so they figured out that all you needed to do was put a little soda in with this syrup and serve it at a fountain, of which you did have fountains in drugstores at that time, and promote it as the temperance beverage. And the temperance movement is associated with emancipating slavery, with women's suffrage movement, with direct election of senators, with the creation of the income tax. There's a whole series of things that these social movements are part of. Initially, everyone views them as somewhat separate, but they're not. They're all the same people engaged in many of the same activities.
Do you see something else coming on the pipeline that's going to start being marketed?
Well, it's called water. Water is, of course, the only beverage that we need to consume from a physiological standpoint. None of the other beverages and all the flavorings that are added and all of the ethanol that's added for the alcoholic beverages really are not anything that you need. The other surprise to me was the number of different beverages that are available simply in a supermarket, not even counting in all of the places like Starbucks and other beverage places that are now opening up around America. It's tens of thousands of choices. And I think that's one of the characteristics of American beverages, this huge diversity. And we've got beverages coming in from other countries that are now beginning to be a part of American beverage scene. And it's a fascinating way of looking at American society, why we really are after that diversity in our beverages. And again, no one needs any of the beverages, even coffee, as exciting as that may be to most of us who get up in the morning. You just need water, and that's the only thing that we really need.
Thank you, Andrew, once again for producing a book that is guaranteed to make us think about things that are just so ubiquitous in our daily life.
Thank you for the interview. It's great.
Andrew Smith is a food historian, prolific author, and frequent guest here on Good Food. We've been talking about his latest book, Drinking History. We can't talk about the history of drinking in America without a look at one of the most quintessential American wines. I'm talking about Zinfandel. Stacy Hunt of Duvan Wine and Spirits and Splash Productions is our resident sommelier here at Good Food. She joins me now to discuss her new ebook, Zinfandel, Beginner's Guide to Wine.
This is a wine that I think is, doesn't get the right kind of respect. Most people know it as California's hometown wine, America's red wine grape. Couldn't be farther from the truth, by the way.
But I really think that a lot of people don't even know that story. So why don't we start with that? How far back does Zinfandel go in California?
Well, in California, it goes back to the gold rush. And I think prior to that, it was an immigrant coming over from Europe. And of all places, the Royal Imperial Gardens of Vienna is where the cuttings migrated first to the East Coast, to a gardener, a horticulturist. And then from there, it made its way west on two levels. Easterners going west to make their fortune, and immigrants coming from Italy and other parts of the world coming to the United States to make their fortune. So Zinfandel ultimately becomes maybe one of the earliest immigrants in this country, and like immigrants that come to the United States, they take on the United States and they become American. And that's kind of the story of Zinfandel. It became an American, naturalized citizen.
And kind of a workhorse wine.
A very workhorse wine. Zinfandel has an interesting way about it. It can be vinified sparkling. It can be vinified light to medium body like a Beaujolais. It can be a heavy, bold, rustic, high alcohol wine. It can be a blush wine, very fruity, light, and sweet. It can be a syrupy, raisiny, really wonderful dessert or port-like wine. So it's an unusual grape that it has that much of a chameleon aspect to it. And it was there to wash down the most unusual menu. We think about the gold rush times. What do you think they were eating? Maybe some grits and maybe
beans.
And beans, yeah. And they probably definitely were. But remember, they were by water. And so they were taking out of the water frogs. So they were having grilled frog's legs and oysters. So when you think about these guys with their fingernails and their nubby hands and sort of not having a bath, yet dining on frog's legs and oysters.
And Zinfandel.
And Zinfandel. So there goes the red wine with fish thing.
So interesting. So there's more to this history. A famed man, Mr. Gergich.
Yes, Mike Gergich. It was living as the American California grape for years. And then in the 60s, a researcher from UC Davis went over to Italy and tasted some Primitivo. And he thought, well, you know, this tastes a lot like Zinfandel. So he came back and reported that. Nothing much happened. A few years later, Mike Gergich, who hails from Croatia, he went over for a visit. And as he went through the vineyards of Croatia and that area, he started noticing these vines looked very similar to Zinfandel vines that he was very familiar with in Napa Valley, which is where he was making wine. So he began talking and asking about it, and people began to talk a little more about some of its history, and then somebody told him about in Italy. And one thing led to another. He got back to the States, went directly to Dr. Carol Meredith at UC Davis and said, "Let's go on a hunt." She, being a DNA expert, said, "This sounds great." And they put together a posse, and off they went to Croatia, and they started doing some DNA testing. So by the mid-1960s, it was pretty clear that this Zinfandel grape had actually come from Croatia, and its real name, you know, before it was Americanized, was called Striljanak Kastelanski. It's very hard to pronounce.
Zinfandel's a little more catchy for us.
A little more catchy for us. But then the DNA testing paper was published in 2001, and therefore its identification and mystery was solved. But what's interesting about it is Primitivo, which is a cousin in southern Italy, now wants to label its wine Zinfandel because of the popularity. And of course, the United States is saying, no, you have to call it Primitivo because, you know, we're really proud of our name.
Talk to me about how White Zin came about.
Okay, let's go back to the mid-1970s, and a guy by the name of Bob Trinchero, at that time, now he has his own winery, but then he was working for Sutter Home, and he was making Zinfandel. And he wanted to get some more color in the grape. He was in the Napa area. And so he was draining off some of the juice to intensify the color. And then he decided, you know, he would vinify that juice he drained off as a white wine. Just, you know, winemakers enjoy playing around. So he did. When he was done with it, he discovered that it wasn't really white. It really had this beautiful rose pink color. And it was wildly fruity, like wild strawberries and wild raspberries. And he thought to himself, what have I got here? And so at that moment, through an accident, blush wine was born. Now, high fruit flavor, which was sort of defined as sweet. And so people talked about white Zinfandel as being a sweet wine. Well, it doesn't have any sugar added. That's not legal. It's just that immense fruit-packed goodness of it. And so everyone discarded it and said, this is fake wine, soda pop wine.
Didn't something happen in that first fermentation where he realized that the yeast couldn't live long enough to consume all the sugar?
Yes, that's correct. That was the accident. He had a stuck, you know, what would be called a stuck fermentation. And so that was another part of the accident that created this gem of a wine. When it was released, now think about California, the United States, we drink sweet drinks. We drink sweetened tea, we drink sodas, we drink all this kind of stuff. And so sometimes a dry wine doesn't really taste good to us until we sort of get our palate used to it.
And this is the 70s.
This is the 70s.
So we haven't
Boone's
had,
Farm.
We haven't really had a chance yet for our wine culture, our modern wine culture, to really evolve.
Right, because it was only in the 70s when the Judgment of Paris took place, where California, for the first time globally, was recognized as a wine-making region to pay attention to. But all of a sudden, we had our own, and it took off like crazy. As soon as it took off, it was disdained. But before we discard it and you know, sniff at it, if you're eating something spicy like Hunan Chinese food or Thai food, any fruity drink that you have with that is going to kill immediately the heat in your mouth. When you drink the white Zinfandel, here's what happens. The heat immediately is extinguished in your mouth. The second thing that happens is the wine doesn't taste so fruity. It now tastes kind of dry, which cleanses your palate and sets you up for the next teary-eyed, runny-nosed, fabulous taste that you're going to have when you put the next bite of that food into your mouth. So it has a purpose. It actually has a pairing purpose. But to your question, can a less fruity version be made? And the answer is yes, in no less than Turley, the cult Zinfandel winemaker, has released for the first time a 2011 vintage of white Zinfandel, although they don't call it white Zinfandel, but it's in a clear bottle and you can clearly see the color. And I think this is going to revolutionize white Zinfandel. It's much drier, still has a lot of beautiful fruit, but it's closer to a European rosé.
Thank you very much.
Thank
and
you,
I would
Evan.
Like to congratulate you on the release of the first that I would imagine is going to be a series of ebooks, very small, short, sweet little things. And this one is Zinfandel 101.
A beginner's guide.
Stacy Hunt comes to us from Duvan Wine and Spirits and Splash Productions. To hear more of our conversation about California Zinfandel, you can find outtakes and a list of Stacy's suggested bottles on the Good Food blog. Jonathan Gold's here next, and he's taking us out for Tex-Mex, so don't go away.
Good Food is produced by KCRW, a listener-supported public radio station. Search for KCRW in the podcast section of iTunes to find other programs like Bookworm, The Treatment, The Business, Unfictional, and DNA. And thanks for listening.
I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. Who is that I see? It's time for Jonathan Gold. He's the Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Times, and every week he joins us here on Good Food with a restaurant recommendation. These days, it feels like we're never going to get out of downtown LA. They're getting a new restaurant every week. And one of the most exciting debuts last month was Bar Ama from Chef Joseph Centeno.
It is a Tex-Mex restaurant, I guess, but not quite a Tex-Mex restaurant like of the sort that you would find if you went to, you know, Houston or Austin. It's its own thing. It's his interpretation of the food that he grew up with in San Antonio.
When I think of Tex-Mex food that hasn't yet percolated to Southern California in a big way, one of the things I think about are puffy tacos.
Yeah, puffy tacos are huge in San Antonio. There's a place there called Henry's Puffy Tacos that is emblematic of the food of the city. I've got to say that we have a puffy taco place here done by Henry's brother that is just as emblematic. And some people say the puffy taco was, in fact, invented in Anaheim. But for the purposes of this conversation, let's assume that they're the San Antonio food, which they are.
And so just for people who've never had a puffy taco, describe what they are.
It is a taco made on a tortilla that has been deep fried, basically, or shallow fried or something in a way that makes it just puff up to the size of a small balloon.
And is it a corn tortilla or flour tortilla?
It's a corn tortilla.
Does it have the look of a tostada? Is it open-faced?
It is open-faced because when you get it, it's still very puffed up from the frying. It will deflate a little bit eventually. But, you know, very fresh oil, very clean frying. In the middle will typically be a scoop of stew, like a guisado, as opposed to grilled meat in the sort of tacos we get here.
And so what is Joseph's take on the puffy taco?
It's big, and it's a big puffy thing. There'll be sort of like a rift in the middle where, you know, maybe some guisado, some stew, or some pork shoulder barbacoa, or maybe some grilled shrimp or potato has been ladled. And there'll be some, it's not quite guacamole, it's like avocado the damage has been done to, and a little bit of salsa, and that's it.
Sounds delicious.
It's so delicious. Again, you know, very clean tasting, very nice thing to have with drinks.
Aside from the puffy tacos, it's a pretty big menu. So what are some of the dishes he's focusing on?
One of the dishes that people in Texas always complain that they can't get here is queso, or queso.
Queso.
And to somebody raised in California or Mexico, for that matter, queso is an absolutely horrifying food. It's basically melted Velveeta with some
Rotel,
straight from the can.
So Rotel is a pico de gallo that's put up in a can. So it's chopped tomato, onion, cilantro, and jalapeno, right? But it's canned.
It's canned. To tell the truth, I sometimes use Rotel to make a slightly different spaghetti amatriciana. It's delicious.
See, I use it for Indian food.
So we're
there you go.
We can't help ourselves. We're from Los Angeles.
Yeah.
But his queso tastes really good. I mean, it has that sort of fluid consistency that you expect from a queso. And it has that smack of cheese that is not legally allowed to call itself cheese.
Yeah, cheese food product, I believe it's called.
Yes. I don't know. Maybe he uses a better thing and he's able to replicate that. If he were smart, he probably would try to reduce the tomatoes or try some magic with Velveeta. But it tastes like queso, only actually good.
And so is queso just served with chips or is it used on a lot of things?
It's served with chips. If you're going to restaurants in Texas, you'll find sort of queso glooped about. But queso is sort of the universal bowl of stuff that comes before the meal with chips. I mean, it serves the function of chips and salsa with us, I guess.
More filling, though.
Well, yeah. It's now, Texas. Everything is bigger.
Now, one of the things I love that Chef Joseph Santano does is his way around vegetables. I think he's an incredible vegetable cook. Is he doing something interesting with vegetables at Barama?
Given that Tex-Mex is not a particularly vegetable-intensive cuisine, yeah, he kind of is. There's a dish that he does in like a hot skillet with kale and zucchini that's cut up and cooked with tomato and garlic and sort of sizzling, and you scoop it up with tortillas, and it's delicious. And there's a dish of cauliflower with sort of a cilantro paste that's,
ooh,
you would think would taste Indian, but instead it tastes Mexican, and I'm not sure quite how. It's probably worm salt from Oaxaca. Anyway, it's that spice salt.
Did you just say worm salt?
Yeah. It's what's supposed to go on the outside of a margarita or a tequila when you have salt on the rim. It's dried gusano worms ground with salt.
What else did you eat? I would want to just have everything on this menu. What else struck your fancy?
The Texas boy I went with was very excited about being able to order chicken fried steak and have nobody laugh at him.
At the price for chicken fried steak, it is no laughing matter.
Right. The puffy tacos are $12. And he's using, you know, heritage pork, and he's using grass-fed prime beef, and he's using Mary's chickens, and that stuff doesn't come free.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So it's good that you mentioned it. And I would imagine, also given the name of the place, Bar Ama, that the drinks must be pretty great that you can imbibe along with this food.
They have a really good selection of tequilas and mezcals, as you might imagine. One of the ones that I was intrigued with are these tequilas called Arte Nom. You know how in Italy you go to the land around Parma and there's all these casificios, all these places making Parmesan cheese, but they can only sell it as Parmesan cheese, but they have numbers on it. This is sort of that. I guess there are a lot of small tequila makers that generally will sell all their product to Sauza or one of the big companies, but some of them are known to be better than others, and so these are sold under the number of the plant.
Oh, that's really great. So it's like a proprietary bottling.
It is. And I could tell you that I really like number 1079, but who knows if that's the one you're going to get next time.
Yeah, absolutely.
They also have decent mezcal selection, including the incredibly hard-to-find Pierre de Alma. Really expensive, but at the top of the line are ones distilled with chicken breast or even more like a wild rabbit hanging in the distilling chamber.
Wow.
Which is supposed to give it some kind of umami.
One would imagine.
For $35 a shot, you'd hope there was something in there.
Yeah. Wow. I've been talking to Jonathan Gold about Bar Ama.